This episode of the Rar Denim Podcast is brought to you by North American Quality Purveyors. Their mission is as clear as their name. North American Quality Purveyors brings together Canadian and American-made men's apparel and accessories from brands devoted to creating quality, crafted products that will stand the test of time. Both online and in their store in Calgary, NAQP carries a curated selection of the best North American products from brands like Railcar Fine Goods, Gitman Brothers Vintage, Rogue Territory, New England Outerwear Co., Tellison, Battenware, DN1920, and of course, Leftfield NYC. NAQP is offering podcast listeners 10% off your order on all regularly priced items with the discount code RAR10. That's RAWRTEN. Buy quality, buy North American Quality Purveyors. Welcome back, RAR Nation, to another edition of our podcast, an audio journey of all things indigo. We've got a very special guest for you today, Mr. Christian McCann, the owner and founder of Leftfield NYC, as well as an industry vet of over 20 years in this business, will be joining us. Christian and I talk about everything from the start of his brand, to the difficulties of manufacturing in the United States, to how the denim game has changed in the last two decades, so stick around. And just a quick note that you're going to hear some popping during the interview, almost like someone is bouncing a basketball. That is just our toes tapping, which the microphone really picked up on, so apologies for that in advance. We've minimized it as much as we can. But I hope you enjoy the show. And I'm here in Ridgewood, Queens, with the owner and designer of Leftfield, New York City, Christian McCann.
Thanks. What's up, everybody?
How long have you been out here?
I've been out here for 6 years. Basically moved out here in, 2009, yeah. During the recession. It was kind of a perfect storm for me, relationship-wise and business-wise, and kind of what I was doing for Japan at the time was just kind of hitting a dead end for me personally. So I came out to Ridgewood from Long Beach, New York, and it was kind of a new start. I was here for 3 years working here by myself.
Yeah.
In major debt, trying to dig myself out of a fucking huge hole.
But you've clawed your way out since then?
I have clawed my way out, and I think I realized after I got divorced I was in a whole $120,000 and
wow.
Trying to figure out when they pulled my bank loan for $100,000 that I had to pay back within 2 months made life interesting.
That's a lot of pairs of jeans.
So. Yeah, it was a lot of stress. It was a lot of, pounders 4 o'clock in the afternoon, sometimes at 10 in the morning,
yeah,
to get through those days. But things are coming along. Like I said, I'm moving to a new spot. Ridgewood's starting to take off. It's supposed to be the new hipster, the new Bushwick or Bushwick West or whatever you want to fucking call it. So we're looking forward to doing a little bit more retail business out here. We've got Chains to Chemer and the Darner that we're going to have up and running. So. Yeah, we do a little bit more business in-house.
A lot of people finding you out here? So you're just off the M train, right?
Starting to. I mean, we get a lot of people just kind of like peeking in the door and saying, what the fuck is this? What do you do? You know, what is this? It's generally a good
jumping off point for the Leftfield story.
But, you know, I think some people actually make their way out here. I think it's kind of a nice little venture, especially if you take the M train. It's mm-hmm. all above ground. You get to drive through Bushwick in the hood and see tons of graffiti and all kinds of, you know, dilapidated buildings and old shit like New York used to be back in the 70s. So it makes a little bit more of an interesting retail experience. And I think the trip is part of it rather than going to Soho or Lower East Side. It's kind of,
It sort of fits your aesthetic a lot better than if you were located in, you know, South Manhattan.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think Manhattan's turned into a different beast at this point. and nobody really can afford to be there. I think anybody that's really wanting to do anything fresh is Queens or outskirts of Brooklyn. I mean, even Williamsburg at this point is fucking is as expensive as Manhattan. So
yeah.
I don't even want to go there anymore.
How long you been in New York total? You've been out here in since 2009.
I've been here since I moved up from Philly in 97.
Yeah.
I used to buy men's clothing for Anthropology. It's kind of where I kind of got interested in clothing.
Yeah.
And
Anthropology had a men's line back then.
Yeah, they did. It was cool. I worked out of the first store out in the outskirts of Philadelphia. And it was an interesting little family to be a part of. We were in the attic of Urban Outfitters on 18th Street, which is now Anthropology.
18th and Walnut?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so we had the whole buying team up in the attic there.
Yeah.
And it was cool.
What were you buying for men back then?
Just a lot of shitty stuff.
Yeah?
I think I was buying... some... Blue Marlin I was actually picking up for certain people. One thing which will probably piss certain people off is I discontinue all their Lucky business.
Really?
That was one little change I did.
You didn't like their denim?
I just thought it was cheesy.
Uh-huh.
It never really took off. It's, you know, it's kind of a woman's store, and it's not really cut out for men, so...
Mm.
The writing was on the wall, and I moved out to New York. In 97, I came out here to potentially work with somebody that screwed me over, and got unemployment. I had 6 months to do something and decided I was going to do my own thing, and I had no idea what the fuck I was doing as far as design, manufacturing, anything really.
So your only exposure before that was buying?
Was buying. I did a little trip to Italy, working on a collection with a manufacturer when I was in Italy, and we actually sold to a few stores, but I turned down that possible position to go work with another person, the other person who eventually hung me out to dry. So, yeah, it was interesting. No idea what the fuck I was doing, calling up people and asking for sweatshirt material, getting hung up on and yelled at and walking the garment district and being screamed at in Chinese, Mandarin, whatever you want to call it, 15 fucking different factories. But, you know, it's all about persistence, and eventually you find somebody that takes the time to try to,
yeah,
you know, hear your story. So...
What was the first collection like? Were you doing mostly sweats? Were you doing jeans back then?
No, I couldn't really afford much. I only had a credit card to live off of, and unemployment, which was basically paying my rent for 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
I did get it was $11,000 line of credit from Bank of America, which is absolutely nothing. I mean, you know, a run of denim costs you $11,000, let alone for the production, you know, making it. So, you know, it was really hard. I did a lot of vintage style sweatshirts that I mixed up with felt lettering. I did some chain stitch emblems on old hoodies. I did some crazy contrast shit like they did back in the 40s, like light blue with dark navy. I did red zippers and red striped varsity stripes on the sleeves, and it was kind of, I guess it was a little bit combination of maybe say streetwear in a loose sense.
And like 40s and 50s athletic wear?
Yeah, so it was kind of a combination, which took off well. And it was selling stores like A-Life. I remember walking in there when they first opened up, and they had Shepherd Ferry would do installations in there, and they had all kinds of local graffiti guys. And for some reason, it just worked. It just kind of happened. Then I started getting into like... doing a lot of applique felt t-shirts. I had sewers down in Coney Island that would straight stitch all the embroideries and stuff, the felt down. I'd have it washed locally in little laundromats, and they'd sew the labels on, and I'd pick it up in my Jeep and load up my Jeep with like 10 laundry bags full of t-shirts and stuff. And that's kind of what the Japanese really loved.
So you were selling primarily to Japan on that
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, the weird thing is I ended up selling Fred Siegel Louis of Boston, which I've never been able to sell again.
Yeah.
I think I sold ships. My first season, I actually did really well.
Did you just, like, find these guys by showing, or was this your old, like, anthropology connections, or...?
No, I mean, I really had no connections with stores like that. My connections were all with buyers, so... I was a buyer with brands, so it was kind of the opposite of what I would potentially want. But, I would send out... I made a crazy, weird catalog based on an old yearbook.
I've seen that lookbook.
I actually...
It was really cool, where you, like, Xeroxed it with different faces and stuff and the product on people.
I made it, actually, in the Brooklyn Library with just a copy machine. And then I did cut and paste. I cut and pasted Left Field, I think, 98 or whatever, on the front of an old vintage yearbook. And that... The front I did in color, all the rest of the stuff, I cut out pictures from yearbooks and hand-drew pictures of what I was doing and wrote in, like, weird little shit that people write in people's yearbooks to make fun of people. So.
Yeah.
It was kind of like...
That did well?
It was kind of like an old zine, and I included one t-shirt with some felt lettering, washed, and at the time, it was, you know, there wasn't anything with that raw kind of aesthetic. The label was... hand stamped, like metal stamp, letterpress style in the Bronx. And it was just, I guess, kind of fresh for that period because there was just absolutely nothing out. I mean, even the Japanese brands weren't. I saw Japanese stuff in Kinokuniya bookstore, is where I first kind of started seeing what was going on in Japan when I was a buyer. And like, what the fuck is this? Why don't we have any of this kind of stuff in America? Why is everything so boring? And I guess with my interest in old things and growing up with parents that were into antiques and, you know, vintage craftsmanship and sensibility, I wanted to do my own version of what the Japanese were doing in Japan. I felt like it's American culture, and it should have been done by at least one American brand.
Yeah.
So that was my take on it. Like, you know, let's bring it back home and do it from a perspective of somebody who actually lives here. Because I think you could definitely tell the difference, especially with the translation issues on t-shirts a lot.
Yeah, the, like, yeah. Watermelon shopping cart, like, yeah. Yankee blue jeans on a pair of a Japanese t-shirt or something.
Yeah, I think sometimes the translators don't always do a very good job at actually what they're trying to get, but that's kind of the beauty of it, I think.
So that was sort of the motivation behind how the brand evolved, like, from there on out, was just, like, you know, bringing back the American sensibility from the way these Japanese brands have been interpreting it.
Yeah, I felt like just from buying and seeing just shit out there, and just, I mean, nothing I ever wanted to wear, and looking at old craftsmanship and looking at old Farsi letters that you found it, I found it, like, flea markets, and, you know, the texture of the felt and washing the felt and straight stitching it and seeing it curl up and just watching it degrade on a shirt is just, to me, was just a beautiful thing. And that's kind of where I started out, and I did a lot of that stuff. Unfortunately, I didn't have enough money to do a real proper collection, which is always something, you know, you look back and resent. What could you do better? What could you start out? You know, I'd like to do a full collection. But, you know, you do what you got to do, and I fucking was just doing that and just learning more and screwing production up and shrinking stuff too much and dyeing stuff that bleached out, doing all the wrong things to figure out how to do them the right way. And just, you know, I made a little bit of money, and pretty much did live work for, I don't know, eight, 9 years of business. I was basically living and breathing everything I was doing every day.
Yeah.
So it was pretty intense.
So that led you up to, like, around 2005, 2006, that version of Left Field was going?
I think, yeah. I mean, I was before I moved out to Long Beach, maybe about 2003, I bought a little bungalow by the beach, and I had a kid out there, and kind of lost sense of reality of being in New York,
mm-hmm.
and being around people that I felt completely estranged from. It's kind of like being back in high school, and being a fucking weirdo again. So I guess that wasn't the greatest years. And then with the recession around the corner and a divorce in the way, I moved back to Ridgewood. I moved everything back myself and threw it into this space. And it was kind of digging my way out for the past 6 years and trying to... When I came back here, I decided I wasn't going to make a lot of the stuff I was doing for Japanese stores. They wanted a lot of applique stuff, a lot of t-shirts, a lot of sweatshirts, and I just didn't want to make that shit anymore. I did it. And I just started making stuff I wanted to. I said to myself, I was at the point where I potentially could go out of business. I was, like I said, $120,000 in the hole. Bank of America was pulling my line of credit. They wanted to get paid. And, you know, you're fucked. I was all by myself in this fucking place trying to figure out what to do. So I said, I'm gonna give it a shot. I'm going to try to do what I want. If it doesn't work out, at least I fucking went out on my own note. Not something I wasn't really into. And it slowly started to turn, and things started picking up. Got rid of the little bit of women's I was doing. I knew I needed to expand where I was at, just in case the brand crashed and burned, so I started Choctaw.
Yeah.
And Choctaw was kind of like just a totally different beast. I was like really into the packaging, mm-hmm. and that's kind of where I like wanted to delve with Left Field more and more into the packaging element of it.
Yeah. And Choctaw, for those who don't know, is your underwear and like undergarments labels, you t-shirts.
Vintage undergarment, inspired undergarments.
Yeah.
But I think with Choctaw, to me, it was really about just the box, like just the box and the packaging and just the experience of opening old products and just how fucking cool they are, like old tins and cigarette boxes and cigar boxes, stuff like that we get nowadays. It's just, you know, you take it and you throw it in the trash the second you see it. Like, I wanted to create something that you would keep and you wouldn't just dispose of the second you took the item out of it. It was almost part of the experience. It was tissue paper, the whole nine yards.
Yeah, it's a cool box. Like, you go the length of embossing everything and you know, really giving you the whole experience of like pulling the sticker off the tissue paper as you open stuff up.
Yeah, we eventually... I didn't start out letterpress, but... For the second round of boxes, we did letterpress paper, recycled paper, so the box is letterpressed, it's wrapped letterpress paper. All the hang tags are custom die-cut shape, an old vintage-style shape. It's double letterpress printed. All the stuff I do for Left Field now, all the flashers for the denim are all letterpress, two-color. The chinos are letterpress. You know, it's important. Packaging is important. It gives a feeling and a little bit of authenticity. You know, when you have a combination of, you know, history and some authenticity, and, you know, moving to New York was kind of the quintessential American experience, you know, moving here with no money. So I had probably first and last and 1 month rent. That I could live off of, so it was a bit of a scramble.
Yeah. Is that when you first started getting into denim, too? Was or raw denim heavily in those collections?
I would say, like, early on, not so much as denim, because it just wasn't really readily available in the U.S., and there just wasn't very much Japanese denim over here at all. I mean, I think, I always say blue and green was the first... you know, light of hope. It was like the light at the end of the tunnel for me when I felt like, you know, I had enough Britney Spears and fucking Justin Timberlake brands dictating fashion and like what the fuck is going on in America, or why is it so horrible? And then, you know, somebody like Gordon comes along and takes, you know, a lot of the passion the Japanese had and Japanese brands, and I was like, wow, this is awesome. This is, you know, maybe like I don't have to just sell to Japan. Maybe I have a market in the U.S. as well.
Yeah.
So that was kind of when I started thinking, like, I don't need to be completely hooked onto the Japanese market. It was a little bit scary knowing that, you know, if I completely pulled out of what I was making for what they wanted, that I would fall on my face because I didn't have any business. I didn't have very much business in the U.S. And people didn't even know what salvage denim was. People didn't know, you know, the difference between buying Chinese good. Nobody gave a shit about made in the U.S. I mean, everybody ideally did. You know, everybody wants to, but nobody bought it. You know, I've had that buy left field, buy American, buy left field for probably 12 years.
Yeah.
And, I mean, not really until the recession hit, I think, people really start realizing how it affects, you know, affects your neighbors, affects your family, people losing their jobs. You know, what happened in Detroit happened in the American sewing industry. You know, we lost millions of jobs. And, you know, I sometimes find it annoying that a lot of the brands that sold a lot of Americans out are now coming back and thumping their chest about how, you know, they're doing a Made in America collection.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially, they're pushing people that have been made in America out of these factories and causing major delays for me, causing my minimums to go up, because now they want to make in America. And now they want to, you know, they want to be part of the whole fucking Born in the USA thing. It's like, it's good, I'm happy for it, but at the same time, it's like, where were you 20 years ago when everything went overseas and NAFTA came about?
There aren't even that many people left to make in America. It seems like the people that are still manufacturing garments today are the same ones that lost their jobs, like around the turn of the millennium, like around the late 90s, early 2000s. So you've got just very, very few highly skilled people that can still do this stuff, and they're really at a premium.
It's true. I mean, I was doing some production out of Blue Ridge, Georgia, and I remember going there, and it was a bunch of blue-haired old ladies that used to work at Wrangler, and I think there was maybe a Levi's factory down there, but... Mm-hmm. There's a few good factories left, and I think it really comes down to training people, skill levels. Quality control is still a fucking massive issue in America. People don't want to pay for quality control. People don't want to inspect garments because they inspect them and they find problems, and they got to take it back to sewers and they got to redo it. So everybody wants to make it and push it out. Certain people do piece price, which means every seller gets paid a certain price for every piece.
Mm.
So as that comes out, there's no room for quality. They want to get as much out as possible. And it's unfortunate because back in the day, like I have emblems from, I think it was called Standard Emblem from Pennsylvania, where I have old chenille emblems where they have actually the operator's number and name on the back of the emblem.
Really? So if you got a crap piece, you can call them up and go like, what the hell, man? My emblem is all fucked up.
You could call out the operator, which I think is really a brilliant idea. I wish more factories would do that, because I think people would take more pride if their name was on the back of that garment or inspection or sticker. You know, it's like not just mass produced stuff. It's like, it's a craft.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, we need to do a lot more education, train people to work in factories. I think it's a valid job, and you know, I'm not quite sure why Obama hasn't pushed the apparel industry. You know, there's millions and millions of fucking jobs lost in the apparel industry that we could get back, and these people need to be trained. I've got factories around Ridgewood that have done some sweaters for me. You've got day labor that come in.
QC on day labor must be just awful.
Oh, it's horrible. They come in, they don't know how to sew. They fuck shit up. they leave to another factory for another 10 cents a garment. And there's absolutely no pride in what they do. So it needs to be restructured.
Are there any tax benefits for working in the U.S. and doing U.S. production at the moment?
No, I mean, that's been, I guess, you know, not... I don't mean to come across as negative. It's just frustrating, you know, years of banging your head against the wall and barely skipping, getting by, you know, sometimes you get a little burnout, but nothing.
There's nothing.
No so tax incentives at all. Yeah. There's more tax incentives to make overseas than there are to make in America. So that's that's another issue that I'm not necessarily pointing at Obama, but, you know, where are the incentives to make it in the USA? We want to bring jobs here. Where are the benefits for American manufacturing to actually manufacture in the U.S.? Where there's so many benefits to not manufacture in the U.S.?
Yeah.
It's kind of bizarre.
Oh, that's messed up. You think that the anyone, like any state legislature or something like that, would want more jobs in their community by that? But then again, when you manufacture in the States, it's sort of like any... like any garment or any like item just in general that's made in the States is automatically a luxury good because it just costs so much more.
Yeah.
It's kind of a shame.
I mean, it's cost, it also comes down to numbers. I mean, you look at something and you figure if a factory's making 50 cents off of a garment and they're making 10,000 garments, they're making $5,000. I always would present it to a factory, if I give you $5 and you do less garments, you still could be potentially making the same amount of money. But for some reason, nobody ever wants to do that. They don't want to set the machines up. They don't want to deal with tricky stuff. Everybody wants to make simple shit. They think it's World War II and we want to make aprons and, you know,
work. Yeah, tote bags. And
yeah, it's stupid shit that... it doesn't, it's not complicated. They don't want to do any contrast.
Because it takes time and it takes skill to, like, you know, put a pocket on a shirt. That's not an easy stitch to do and, like, not make it pucker or to, you know, sew the yoke of a pair of jeans together.
Yeah. I mean, like you said, but as far as pocketing, like, for the recent tube tees I just ran, we made it in a factory that can make t-shirts but can't put pockets on them. They can't stitch the little...
they can't put the little...
the little triangle stitch, yeah, that I went on the back. They were just going to do a straight stitch, and I like the little triangle stitch in the corner. So for me to do the triangle stitch, I had to send it to a different factory, and the other factory had to put the pocket on. And just the amount of drama over putting a pocket on a t-shirt in America sometimes is, like, absolutely fucking comical. You know, stuff like that. Even, like, making t-shirts, I used to make 100% yarn dyed t-shirts, yarn dyed heathers, which is similar to, I guess, rope dyeing, but even more intricate because the actual fibers are sometimes dyed different colors, and you have each little fiber that's spun into a yarn, and then you have multiple colors within one yarn. And it's a little tricky, but, you know, just for one color t-shirt, when I started out doing my own custom tees, which took a little bit of time, it started out 1,000 pounds minimum at about 4-something a pound and went up to 4,000 pound minimum, 4-something, 5-something a pound. So potentially you're looking at $20,000 of inventory to make one color t-shirt. And sometimes people have no idea. You know, I'll show them in this t-shirt and they'll be like, "Wow, I don't like that one. I like the plain ones." And pull your hair out because you just invested $20,000 in that color
to make that one t-shirt.
And you got another guy that's coming and making everything PFD gray goods, and he's just throwing in a giant garment bath and dunking, you know, 200 t-shirts and one dye bath.
You want it red, you want it pink, you want it blue, like, I can do whatever.
And and you know, you've went to a specialty level and people don't get it and they don't care and they want... yeah, it's weird. I had Barney's tell me they wanted, at the time I think I was using American Apparel, they wanted American Apparel t-shirts over the custom yarn dyed heathers, which kind of sent me in a spiral.
Oh, but the past few years, have you noticed like a more educated consumer that is aware of, you know, like what yarn dyed indigo, like the benefits of it, and why they would want something like that more than just your standard, you know, like bath dyed something?
Yeah, yes and no. I mean, I think people still don't understand. I mean, I've got no issues against garment dye indigo, but. Mm. It's just a different depth. You're never going to get the same depth mm-hmm. on a garment dye as you are on a rope or a yarn dye.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of people make sneakers and they're dunking them in dye. I think on a home level, it's cool, but from a production level, I think, I don't know. I think yarn dye is like, it's just a different, you know, it's just on a different plane.
Yeah, but like, are you seeing more people that like know what yarn dye is and can appreciate it? Because it's the same thing, if you know, like 10 years ago, nobody knew what selvage or, you know, like rope indigo dyeing was in the States, and now there are a lot of people that do know about that and appreciate it. Are you seeing the same thing with like other aspects of manufacturing, that people are getting like pickier and more aware and educated on the clothing they're buying?
A bit. I still think the yarn dye process, especially with indigo right now, and even garment dyeing versus yarn dye, like, you know, for t-shirts, it's one thing, you know, people who garment dye chinos and stuff, and it's just a really cheap way of mass producing chinos. And, you know, I go out of my way to never do yarn dye bottoms and certain items. I think it just, you know, you want, preferably yarn dye is the best. Piece dye is when you actually dye the fabric,
mm-hmm.
which is a better dyeing process. But yarn dye is the richest dyeing process, and that's the most expensive. So a lot of people, you know, they get chinos and they spend $250 on them, and then you don't realize that it's, you know, it's a PFD garment dyed piece. It's not even special. It's just, you know, things like that, I feel like people don't get. I think people obviously get salvage. Everybody wants it. I think it's almost to the point where it's a basic. Like, it's not really something you have. It's like, it has to be salvage. It's not really special because it's salvage, you know. But yarn dyed indigo, I think, is one thing that I think people don't really get the difference between yarn dyed and garment dyed. And I think the richness of yarn and rope dye over a garment indigo dye.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think, I don't know. To me, garment dyeing looks too rich. I used to tie dye as a kid in ninth grade and stuff. It looks just doesn't have the brilliance in the color like, you know, some of the Japanese fabrics, you know, really rich yarn dyed fabrics are just exceptional that you can't get in a garment dye.
Mm-hmm. Oh, back to American manufacturing. You're having all these headaches with putting stuff together, putting pockets on t-shirts. Is there ever a point where you would consider not manufacturing in the United States? It's like, what does it mean to you, and like, what keeps you here?
I guess for left field, it's kind of it's always been a major emphasis, and my core customer was Japanese people. That's always been an emphasis. And for me, it's like, you know, there's so many people out there doing vintage t-shirts and vintage pocket tees and vintage washes and vintage this. You know, there's so many people faking the front, you know, what it is to start a brand from a grassroots level and to believe in what you're doing to the level that your whole life kind of depends on it. And it's like, you know, people start up companies and they're just doing all the same shit that everybody else is doing, and they want to call it vintage. And if it's not made in America, it's kind of like not real to me. It's like, you know,
yeah,
are you not gonna make, I mean, if I was Japanese, I would make my jeans in Japan because that's my culture. But we're Americans, and I want to make American jeans. It's like, this is like I said, this is our culture. This is not to say that people can't do it from their own country, but we need to have people manufacturing blue jeans in America. It's kind of like basic. That was an issue for me. Why aren't people making jeans in America? Why isn't Levi's making jeans in America? You know, like, why did they shut down all their plants, you know?
Yeah. So that's always going to be, left field is always going to be made in the U.S.
Yeah, left field, definitely.
Cool, good to hear. Like, what do you think about these, like, new brands that are popping up with all these, like, sort of zeitgeisty popular type terms that are also sort of co-opting made in U.S., like, salvage, just sort of, like, spitting it out, a lot of these fly-by-night guys that are popping up?
I don't know.
Not to put a slant on them before I ask you the question.
No, I mean, I you know, this is obviously an issue for everybody, especially people that are old school.
Yeah.
I mean, I come from the background that you believe in something, you work for it, you know, a lot of blood, sweat, and tears go into it before it's made, and you finally get a product out that you believe in, and then, you know, you get some press, and then people talk about it. And it's kind of frustrating nowadays where it's like, everybody just wants to be famous and take pictures of themselves and, you know, be a celebrity before they've developed a product. And sometimes I feel it's almost backwards. It's like, you know, people ask me for money to make a garment. It's like, if you believe in what you're doing, you shouldn't ask other people for money to make a garment. You should believe, you should go out there and get your money, old school, develop your business, and bust your ass it used to be. It's like, people, it's just too easy nowadays. You know, like, people want to do, everyone wants to make fucking jeans, everyone wants to make sweatshirts. Let's start up Kickstarter, let's be cool, let's take pictures of ourselves, and let's hang out. It's like, I don't know, I kind of feel like Kickstarter is like a crutch. It's like, it's like fast fashion, it's, you know, it's like the fast way to get to something. I kind of believe in grassroots. Like, go out and bust your ass and get your own money and start out and build it up. And, like, that's, I don't know. I feel like there's, with a little bit of history that way, I think it shows in the product. I think it shows in the essence and the core of a product when you go through. It's like an artist. The more shit you go through, the more it kind of comes through the work. And people that just, they're like, fuck it, I don't want to work, I'm going to start my own denim line or whatever they're doing, and want everybody else to pay for it, I think it's kind of fucked up, to be honest with you.
Yeah. They just, make a video rather than make jeans.
Yeah, and it's like, let's take pictures of ourselves, and let's take pictures of our friends partying and high-fiving each other and going to, you know, factories and stuff. It's like, no, just fucking do it. Just don't. I mean, most of the stuff, you know, starting your own business is really about isolation. It's kind of like a really hard process. It's like you're doing shit by yourself because you don't have the money. Because nobody else is doing it. And you have to go through it. It's like you have to, it's like your own personal hell years. And I feel like people are kind of like sidestepping. It's like you're not going through the apprenticeship or whatever that it takes.
The school of hard knocks to get your brand off the ground.
Yeah, I mean, I don't mean to sound like an old, you know, fart or something, but there's a certain truth to, like, companies that are built by their bootstraps from their own money. You know, starting out, sewing themselves. I mean, guys are out there sewing their own jeans and making their own shit. I have mad respect for it. I mean, it's never been my business model. I want to sell jeans at a price that I think is affordable. You know, I think over $220 for a pair of cone denim jeans is ridiculous. And personally, I could care less who sewed them. So, you know, as long as everybody has the same concept, like, let's keep it affordable for people. This isn't luxury fabric. This is denim. It's workwear. Just kind of treat it that way, and, like, let's not be too precious about everything.
Yeah, but I definitely feel you on the bootstraps mentality, because that's where we're going right now with Rar Denim. Like, we haven't had any investment.
Yeah.
We haven't raised any money whatsoever. It's just all been organic, and it's tough. Like, you're hungry, and sometimes it sucks, and, like, you can really doubt yourself a lot of the time. But if you just stick with it, you know, maybe sometimes it works out.
I mean, I think at the end of the day, it's also like, you know, you learn how to, like I said, you know, work. I worked here for 3 years by myself. You do what you got to fucking do to get by. I never ask anybody for money. I never ask my friends to pay for my next production run. It's like, I did it myself and I felt like, I don't know. You know, you don't ask people for shit like that. You don't ask people for money so you can go on tour to Europe. You know, you got kids asking, you know, buy a t-shirt for $60 so I can go on to Europe and tour. It's like, hey, I want to go to fucking Europe too. Like,
yeah.
You know, the mentality is just backwards. I don't know. I feel like it's like, it's all about me. I don't know. It's just like, you just gotta hunker down and you gotta yeah. go through it. You
it's
know?
It's immediate like, gratification.
Yeah, it's not fast food. It's like, if it's a passion, I think ultimately the way you guys are doing it, people respect that.
Yeah.
People respect when they know that there's not investors in there. Once you get big investors, all of a sudden distribution changes, product changes, where it's made changes, philosophy changes. You know, if you do it the way you want and you sacrifice a lot of your life to keep it that way, that's, you know, hopefully people respect that and stay true to the brands and companies that live that lifestyle, and not companies that say, hey, I'm going to sell a pair of jeans $10 cheaper than this guy because I'm selling it direct to the retailer. And I just got into this last year and graduated college. I don't know. You know, it's all good. Just have passion. You know, whatever. If people have passion, what they're doing, just come out with something original. If you're gonna come out with a new pair of jeans, just don't copy everybody else's shit. Just do something that stands out from the pack. You know, just don't. It's too easy to put like a pair of, you know, generic buttons on a pair of jeans. Generic stamp, and then
get them sewn at the same place.
Yeah, with a pair of cone denim, it's like, yeah, it's not that hard to make. It's like, not hard to make a hamburger, but certain people do it better, and certain people have a little more pride that they do.
Yeah, should start a Kickstarter for hamburgers. I think that'd be a good one.
I mean, I wish, to be honest with you, I wish, you know, I was watching American Graffiti the other night, and it's like,
yeah.
God, you look at like Mel's Diner in those places and just like wish, you know. Like, I don't want to go to Johnny Rockets to experience that. I want to go to like, you know,
yeah.
some little South Philly spot that used to do it that way. That has the old countertop and, you know, the old soda fountain.
Yeah. You've been to Melrose Diner down there in South Philly?
Yeah.
Oh, it's a great place.
Yeah, there's some sick ones down
there. Yeah. It's right next to the that bar that stays open after hours, yeah. Republican.
One of the Coke spots.
Yeah.
I tried to avoid those back in my days.
Oh, well, that it's the Republican. It's like this hipster like stripper bar.
Yeah.
It's pretty great. But yeah, like it's so much of it has been like these ideas of the past that have been repackaged and like, you know, made safe.
Yeah.
Like you're saying, like Johnny Rockets, because like you can go there with your family and like, you know, the cook's not gonna like go and swear at you or spit in your food if you're an asshole, but it's kind of cool if you would.
Yeah,
there's a certain charm about that I think is a bit lost.
Yeah, there's a certain charm about like just those grumpy old fucking people that started their business and, you know, they crawl out of their little fucking hole in the wall.
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes they're not always friendly, but they're like hardcore, you know.
Those yeah, they can like yell at you and tell you to get lost, like leave their business because they own it.
Yeah.
They can you know, it's not corporately defanged.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's, you know, I think that's really the most important thing is just kind of really growing up grassroots. I think that really builds character, and not only in the person that's starting a brand, but the brand itself, you know. It's like,
yeah, and so many of these guys are cutting out retailers. Like, that's sort of the big like push behind these new crowdfunded brands is like, we sell it direct to you so it's cheaper. But, you know, like, I'm a big fan of the retail experience, and, like,
yeah.
You obviously, like, have built up a lot of, like, serious relationships with your stockists. Like, what do you think about the retail experience versus just buying stuff online, and like what's lost?
Well, I mean, for us, we don't really sell any stores that don't have brick and mortar.
Yeah,
I have my own online store. I know sometimes people have issues with it.
But you also have your own retail store here that we're sitting in.
At the end of the day, nobody realizes that, for example, last year when I went to cut sweatpants, I think I had less than 20 pieces on order. And I cut 180 pairs of sweatpants. If I don't have an online store or somewhere I can get rid of it, guess what? I'm buried. And it's like so many products that if I was a corporation, Choctaw would have never got off the ground. Half the stuff I made would have never got off the ground because nobody buys into it. I mean, I'm not trying to put down a lot of buyers, but a lot of people go safe. Mm-hmm. So for me, it's important to have my own operation to be able to move it. Because if I believe in something and people don't want to take the chance on it, then it either fails or I have to find an outlet to push it. But at the same, I think I went off on a tangent. Back to stock is, I think stores and customer service, I think it's really important. And I think, you know, direct to retail, that's great. It kind of throws a monkey wrench in it for everybody because...
Yeah, your margins are way, way different direct to retail versus going to a stockist.
And, you know, they could sell a lot cheaper. But it's like anything, you know, you have to put your money in brands that you believe in and you think that have character and the same kind of belief systems that you do. You know, obviously, salvage denim isn't a cheap man's game, you know, so it's expensive, a poor man's game. And, you know, if you got the money and you believe in the brand and stuff, then buy the brand that you think, you know, it deserves it, not the brand that's selling it fucking, you know, $10 cheaper or trying to come out with the latest gimmick. And I don't know, man. It's like cheating. It's like, to me, it's kind of cheating. Mm. And it's frustrating, but, you know, it's a new reality that you have to deal with.
I'm also a big fan of the retail experience just myself. They, like, a lot of these stores that you go to all over the country, that they've sort of become these cultural hubs about like where the people in this city hang out and like talk about jeans and like ride motorcycles, and it's where the appreciation for this stuff develops.
Yeah.
And it's you know, where you get new converts to the denim world is through real people having real stuff and like, you know, really exposing their communities to it.
Yeah. I mean, I think as well as just, you know, it's hard selling online only, and I don't sell Choctaw anybody or left field online only, because half the experience of the product and what I'm into is
you gotta feel touch it, and feel it.
The touch, the character, the fabric, the slubbiness, the nep, the softness, the hand. You know, there's so many different, the color that, you know, you do yarn dyed heathers or you do rope dyed, you know, indigo t-shirts. You're not gonna see that on an online store. You're not gonna get the depth of a natural indigo in natural light. You know, you just don't see that, and you don't appreciate what makes it more expensive. It's like all nuance. Why, you know, what makes a $200 bottle of wine that much better than a $20 bottle of wine? It's all these little subtle nuances that you can't get on a online experience. So, you know, I think it's a different level. When you're at a different level of, if anything in life, you have to experience it in person. I agree with you.
And hopefully you've got a dude there that's in the store that can actually, like, you know, walk you through the difference of it.
Yeah.
And why it's worth it. Or, you know, you read Rar Denim every day and you know that already.
Oh,
so
exactly. Rar Denim, I'll tell you everything about everything.
Yeah, like, there's no comparison to just seeing it in person and really having your first experience in a pair. Yeah.
I mean, even trying them on and just, you know, understanding is the fact of the stretch, mm-hmm. you know, barely getting them on and you know, the nuances of raw denim. I mean, I don't know how many times we sent people out a pair of jeans and now it's either too tight. You know, if they're in the store, I say, hey, you button them up, they're going to stretch out. You know, you can kind of talk the customer through understanding the process. Whereas you ship to somebody, like, fuck, it doesn't fit. Like, I'll send them back.
Yeah.
And you go through that four times, and then they buy the sizes that fits them. And then 2 weeks later, it's stretched out, and they're complaining that it's too loose, and it doesn't fit well.
Yeah.
So it's like, yeah, you have to have certain things in person.
Yeah, it takes a knowledgeable consumer.
Just the face-to-face, you know, it's old school stuff. It's important.
Oh, what's next for Left Field? What you got a bunch of stuff coming out for fall winter.
Yeah, I mean,
I imagine
we're trying to expand the collection, be more of a collection. I'm gonna probably do some special shirting, retail, yeah. Direct to retail. I can't compete directly with shirting, so. We're probably going to do potentially some really high-end, like I was saying, potentially some Khadi, hand-spun, hand-loom fabrics.
From India.
From India, direct. And certain fabrics out there are just too fucking expensive to sell. You just can't. And I don't want to charge somebody $400 for a woven shirt. I know people do, but we're gonna do some of that. Want to beef up our sweatshirts. We're definitely gonna get into more packaging. I would love to do a Made in America sneaker.
Yeah.
If I could find somebody to vulcanize goddamn sneaker, I don't understand why that's so impossible. But I hear it might be in the works. PF Flyers, I think.
They're going to do Made in USA sneakers again.
I've heard. I mean, I know New Balance owns them, so.
Yeah.
New Balance makes in US. I don't understand. I don't understand why companies like Converse aren't doing a huge collection in America. I
mean, yeah.
The amount of money they've made off of Americana and American culture. Why not throw us a bone and make a factory in US and do a small collection? People are willing to pay. I mean, people are spending $160 on Made in America New Balance versus $80, wherever they are. You know, they're spending extra money. People want it. That as well as denim. It's like, I keep saying, why is Cone the only game in town? It's like, why can't anybody salvage denim from anybody except for Cone? Why are their looms 24/7 and we can't get, you know, different types of denim going through, different types of ducks. It's like, I think at this point, I don't even understand why the Japanese haven't brought over Toyota looms to set up operation here. I think the Draper looms are great, but I think they have certain restrictions. I don't, you know, you can't run the heavy 23 ounces on those looms. I don't think anybody's ever run that stuff, and that's, you know, set up operation. Let's get America competitive again. You know, it's like, we got limited factories, we got limited fabrics. You know, it's like, if I had more options to buy American fabrics, I would be buying more American fabrics. But unfortunately, I don't.
So, and if you could get a tariff or a tax incentive to help you out, it might encourage a lot more people to take the plunge.
Yeah. I mean, and anybody that wants to set up operation, you know, look, that's how America was built, on competition. We've got one salvaged denim company, salvaged denim mill right now. It's insane. You know, pretty much the birthplace of denim, and we have one mill. So I welcome it, and I think it's coming. I hear it's coming. So I'm hoping it comes soon for more options.
Yeah, well, thanks so much for taking the time, Christian. I really appreciate it, and it was a pleasure to have you on.
Awesome, man. Great. Same as well.
This episode of the Rar Denim Podcast is brought to you by North American Quality Purveyors. Their mission is as clear as their name. North American Quality Purveyors brings together Canadian and American-made men's apparel and accessories from brands devoted to creating quality, crafted products that will stand the test of time. Both online and in their store in Calgary, NAQP carries a curated selection of the best North American products from brands like Railcar Fine Goods, Gitman Brothers Vintage, Rogue Territory, New England Outerwear Co., Tellison, Battenware, DN1920, and of course, Left Field NYC. NAQP is offering podcast listeners 10% off your order on all regularly priced items with the discount code RAWRTEN. That's RAWRTEN. Buy quality. Buy North American quality purveyors. All right, it is time to answer some reader questions. If you have a question that you would like us to answer on air, please either send it to info@rawrdenim.com or you can post it in the question section of our forum. Oh, our first question comes in from Lee W. Lee asks, "Hi, been reading your site, was wondering if you could point me in the right direction. Looking for more of a loose, baggy raw denim. I can't do the straight, slim leg denim. Thanks." Okay, Lee, you're definitely in the minority there because there aren't there aren't that many options out there for the loose, baggy raw denim. As like most people tend to do the slim or like tapered leg, but a lot of the heritage cuts tend to have fuller fits. So a couple of the good ones from Japan would be Sugarcane with their Okinawa and Hawaii fit are fuller legs. So you'll find a bit more room there. And then the Levi's Vintage Clothing, those fits that specifically the ones before 1940. So like the 1937, the 1922, the 1915, the 1890, and even the 1878 are all super billowy, like waist overalls is what they were called. Some don't even have belt loops. So those have very full cuts, but still have the same, you know, high quality of denim and details and, you know, high quality manufacturing as some of their slimmer fitting cousins. So I hope that helps you out there, Lee. And next question here is from Nico Subito. Nico asks, "I have been seeing more and more people use this type of cuff," and he included a picture here of pin-rolled cuffs. "I wear a lot of sneakers, and I think this looks great with a pair. I was wondering if you could tell me how to do it." So pin-rolling is something that was really popular in the 80s. If you ever see any of those old John Hughes movies or something like Back to the Future, you can spot the pin-rolled cuffs like as far as the eye can see. Pin-rolling is actually not that hard. What you can do is just grab as much of the fabric as you can from the inside of the jean, like near the inseam, and fold it over on itself on the inseam. So then while you have like, you know, that couple inches of denim tucked under itself, you just roll up the bottom of the cuff really, really tightly. So like maybe three or four rolls. So you get, you know, not that flat looking type cuff you get on a double or a single cuff, but it actually looks, you know, like a ball of fabric. So once you have that, you'll get that super skinny looking tapered leg, and you've got pin rolls there, Nico. So hope that helps you out. Finally, Stuart Robertson writes, "I love the site, but I can't find any info on dry cleaning raw denim. Is dry cleaning an alternative to washing them during the 6 month to 1 year break-in period? If so, are there any specific instructions to give the dry cleaners, assuming it's acceptable?" Well, it is acceptable, first of all, Stuart. You can just drop them off at your dry cleaners and, you know, have them treat them like any other pair of slacks. But a couple things you want to be sure of is you want to make sure that they're dry cleaning them, because some of these dry cleaners also have laundries, and you might end up with your pants going through a wash and machine drying cycle, which would just be way worse than even washing them in the first place. So make sure you're specifically asking them to dry clean them when you're turning them in, and also be sure that they don't press them. Normally, when a dry cleaner gets something, they iron out like the legs, so they're flat and stiff as a board. But with raw denim, what you want is to keep those creases from your wear marks, especially before the first wash. So if they iron them out, all of your work is almost undone. So just keep that in mind, and good luck at the dry cleaners, Stuart. Okay, that about does it for us this time around. Special thanks to Christian McCann for coming on this week. You can find more about Left Field at leftfieldnyc.com. And again, big ups to North American Quality Purveyors for sponsoring this week's episode. You can, again, get 10% off all regularly priced items on their store with the discount code RAR10. All right, thanks again for tuning in, guys, and hope to see you next time.